Well, it's very nice, Miss Gina. Thank you for doing that. It would have been nice for you to have been here in person to do that, but it was very good. It came through very nice. So you have special music every week? Is that right? Every other week? Yes? We got some singers and performers? That's nice. How about a choir? No. Okay, I won't go that too far. All right. So speaking of that, that leads me to my introductory question. How many of you have ever seen a miracle? Experienced a miracle? You can all put your hands up. Everybody, put your hands up, because you know why? You're seeing one right now. You are seeing a miracle. You got one standing right in front of you. It is a miracle from God that has led me to be standing here today speaking to you as your pastor, your new pastor. And that was a miracle, and I'm about to tell you why. How much do you believe that God is involved in the events of your life? He's very much involved in your daily life. Again, do you think that maybe sometimes God is too busy to be that involved in your daily life with the decisions that you are faced with, the problems that you have, the trials that you have? Why do you suppose it is we're told that the very hairs of our head are numbered? Some of us have more than others. Some of us have less. It's not so hard. But the analogy is there. God knows a lot about us. He's very concerned. So I submit to you that God is constantly aware of you. God is overseeing your growth and development, your spiritual maturity, bringing you to perfection as a child of God. He is nurturing you, protecting you, providing for you, teaching you, training you. But most of all, God is loving you. He's our parent. He's a loving father. You're his child. And don't we all like to do things for our children? It's really nice to see that we have a lot of kids here. We had, what, 6 kids, I think, up in Indianapolis this morning. So that was great. I heard, oh, this is an old church. Well, with 6 kids, it was really nice. Yeah, there were a few that were chronologically challenged, but they were there. So let's go to Matthew 7. About giving gifts to our children. Matthew 7, verse 7. I am not known for giving people a lot of time to turn to the scriptures, but since this is our very first one, and I want a drink of water, I'll wait. Now I'll probably spill that. Matthew 7, verse 7. We're told, ask and it shall be given to you. Seek, you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. He who seeks finds, and to him who knocks, the door will be open. So now we have the analogy, the story. So which of you, if his son asks for bread, you give him a rock? You imagine that. Hey, Dad, I'm hungry. I want a slice of bread. Here's this rock. Chew on that. Yeah. Or if he asks for a fish, you get a snake. Now, some would like that. You know, my granddaughter, both of them, they love snakes. Their dad taught them to love snakes. You know who I'm talking about. So they would say, okay, a snake, but I don't think they would eat it. But, all right, so that the analogy is here. If you then, though you are evil, you know how to give good gifts to your children. So you give them bread, you give them a fish, whatever they want. You know how to give good gifts to your children. Well, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So we are told to ask. God is a perfect parent. He is involved in every aspect of our lives if we'll step back and let him. If we yield to him, yield to his will and his guidance in our lives. And that's something that I had to learn, and I think we all have to learn that. So looking back over our lives now, Nancy and I have been together almost 49 years, we can see so many times of God's involvement and God's miracles in the events of our lives. And often, it's taking place. We don't even realize it's happening. It's only when you look back in hindsight, oh, man, that's how that worked out. That was certainly God helping us through that. So there can be times when God is most involved in our lives and we're not actually aware of it. We don't notice it until we look back. Now, I think one of the most incredible examples of this in the Bible, and I thought we ought to have at least one good Bible story here in the sermon, which will be a different type of a sermon. You'll see what I'm talking about in a little bit. But let's go and learn a little bit more about the story of Joseph. Here's a guy who could have easily thought that God abandoned him, and the guy was no longer working in his life. He had worked, you know, with his father, the patriarchs, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Yeah, but no, Joseph now is alone. He's sold into slavery by his brothers, and he has no way out of this predicament. And yet, we know, looking back on the story, that God was about to work incredible miracles in his life. But Joseph didn't know that at the time. He realized it looking back. Genesis 39, let's rehearse the story just a few minutes here of Joseph. We'll get to the part where he had actually been taken down into Egypt, verse 1. So Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, he was the captain of the guard, purchased him from the Ishmaelites. Remember, they took him from the brothers, you know, who had taken him down into Egypt. So verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. So now Joseph's living with Potiphar. And when his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the God gave him success in everything he did. So that's an obvious example there for Potiphar to see that, wait a minute, this guy is different. Joseph's God is giving him success in everything he did. Now, Potiphar didn't know who the God of Joseph was, but he could see that this was special. So Joseph found favor in Potiphar's eyes and became his attendant. He's the number one guy. Potiphar puts him in charge of his household. He entrusted to his care absolutely everything that he owned. Joseph gets to be in charge of that. And then from the time that he put in charge of his household and all that he owned, then God blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. And that often happens sometimes, even at our work. You know, when we're working for someone, God may bless our employer because of our presence there. And because God is blessing us, he will bless what we're in contact with, what we're associated with. So that's the case here. So the blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and also in the field. So he left in Joseph's care everything. And with Joseph in charge, he didn't concern himself with anything except, here's the most important thing to Potiphar, the food that he ate. He was well fed. So kind of picture Potiphar as this, you know, maybe not. Rotund guy because he's so obsessed, it says, with his food. That's all he cared about. All right, so things are going a little bit better now for Joseph, but was not to last. Things were about to get a lot worse. And so you know the thing that happened with Potiphar's wife. So where does Joseph end up? Okay, verse 19, his master heard the story, and of course he's going to hear one side, the story that his wife told. And he said, "This is how your slave treated me." That's what she said. Well, then he burns with anger. And Joseph's master, Potiphar, took him, put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, a very special place. You don't get out of it. And while Joseph was there in the prison, God was still with him, and he showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. And the warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because he didn't have to. God was with Joseph, and God was giving Joseph success in everything that he did. So the warden sees that, and he says, I still get my salary, and I don't have to do anything. Joseph takes care of it all. So Joseph is stuck in prison. He's getting, you know, some work to do, but he has no hope of ever getting out. So do you think that Joseph really knew and believed that God was right there still with him, attentive to every detail, knew exactly what was going on, actively involved in every aspect of Joseph's life? It would seem that was not. Joseph could easily have thought that, but apparently he didn't. Apparently he still knew that God was with him. My question is, would we know that and would we believe that if we found ourselves in such a situation? We don't know what we have yet to face, but we can never give up on God. So we know the rest of the story, and we know what eventually happened. Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dreams. He's put in charge of all of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh himself. God clearly was in total control, working out his plan to preserve Israel. He knew about the famine that was coming and all that. And God also had a story that he was about to have acted out, and that was the story of the Exodus. You know, he knew about Passover and the days of unleavened bread, and he knew what had to happen with Israel and Egypt and coming out of Egypt and that whole thing, that God was orchestrating this whole plan. And Joseph is intimately involved in that. And God's working one miracle after another in Joseph's life. So again, do we ever think God is not involved directly in our lives? He is working with us. He is preparing us for his kingdom every bit as much as he was preparing Joseph. So is he working with us. He's totally involved with you. Now, God, I have come to see, has been also been totally involved in my life as well, and of course, Nancy's as well. And sometimes we didn't realize it at the time. So, as I said, I know all of you are a bit curious to know just who is this guy? Who is this couple? You maybe have seen us before or met us before, but if I'm going to be your pastor, you need to know just a little bit more about who we are and how we came to be here today. So this sermon, the rest of it, will be kind of my icebreaker, if you will. So I think you do need to know us a little better, and I'll get to know you as well. But I wanted to help you get to know us by telling you how God has been so miraculously involved in our lives, the major events of our lives, just like I know he has been so involved in your lives as well. So one of the first questions that people ask when they are talking to new people they're meeting in the church is, well, when did you come into the church? Or how did you first find out about the church or the truth? Well, how I first came to be in church was because of my dad, my mom and dad. I was 12 years old at the time. It was 1966. And dad had been getting the Plain Truth magazine since 1959. So the World Tomorrow broadcast and the Plain Truth magazine goes back about as long as I can remember, 1959. I would have been about 5 years old or so at the time. But Dad was a little bit slow to act. So finally, about, I think it was around May of 1966, he asked for a visit. And sure enough, Mr. Roy Holiday came to our house. A lot of you know who that is, okay? But my sister and I didn't want anything to do with it. My sister is a year and a half older than I am, and we stayed in the basement and we played Monopoly. And so finally, Mr. Holiday was ready to leave, and Dad yells downstairs, said, "Get up here. You need to meet this man, you know, be polite." So we shook his hand and said hello and all that, and he left. And Dad said, "Well, we're going to start going to church on Saturday now." "We are. Where?" "Well, we're going to drive down to Charleston." Charleston was a two-hour drive on the crookedest road in West Virginia. Well, the second crookedest road in West Virginia. But I'll tell you later about the most. But it was a trip to get down to where church was. So being 12 years old and 13, you know, I'm in school, and I'm suddenly not going to church where I used to go to church, and people are saying, what are you doing? Where are you going to church now? What's the name of your church?" "Radio Church of God." "Radio Church of God, you know, and when do you go?" "We go on Saturday." "Where do you go? Where do you meet?" In the Charleston Civic Center, in the South Gallery. What? It was a little embarrassing to say the least, because, you know, I was the only one that was different, and it was a little bit hard to say that. So I relate when sometimes it's hard to tell your friends, although today I don't think it matters. Nobody cares where you go to church. All right, so I went through my high school years, and people accepted me and all that. And so in 1972 is the year I graduated from high school. And so what did church kids do when they graduated from high school in the early 1970s, the late 60s and the early 70s? What did church kids do? They went to Ambassador College. Remember that? Yeah, that was the thing to do. That was a rite of passage, kind of like FI today. You were expected to go to Ambassador College. So I went, and I was kind of reluctant because, believe it or not, I was just a bit shy. I didn't like speech class in high school. I didn't like giving book reports. I was a bit too shy to even give a book report, but I had to do it anyway. So I was most afraid of first-year speech under Ronald Kelly. He was dean of students at the time. So I didn't want to take that class, so I managed to find a way not to, and didn't take speech till my second year under, I forget the guy's name, but I think I gave two speeches the entire year because we listened to him talk instead of us. Brian Clark, or Clark, something like that was his name, I think was it. Anyway, so I was a reluctant student. I enjoyed a little bit the time I was there, but not so much the classes. And so in 1974, they offered the opportunity to have an associate degree program. there were eight of us who qualified to have the associate degree in 1974, and I was one that had that, and I decided to take it, as did seven others of us as well. Because I had decided then and there that I did not need the third and fourth year of Ambassador College, since those years are designed for only the men who are going to be ministers and maybe their wives. And I knew one thing for sure, I was never going to be a minister. So that was that. So I didn't know what was going to happen in my future. And this is a sermon about miracles, right? So, all right. So, being now a bachelor in summer, the fall of 1974, I happened to become interested in a young lady who's sitting on the second row. And Wheeling and Charleston were a circuit at that time under Mr. Holliday. Wheeling was way to the north, and they met at 9:30 in the morning, and Charleston met at 3:30 in the afternoon. And Mr. Holliday just made it to services at 3:30 because it was such a long drive between Wheeling and Charleston. No interstates back then either. So down along the river and then some of that crooked road I was telling you about. So anyway, I knew who Nancy was because Charleston and Wheeling met together for the Holy Days. They met halfway up in the Parkersburg area. So see, even that's where I get my idea of meeting halfway for the Holy Days. It's been ingrained in me since the time I was a kid. So I knew who the Christopher family was. Her dad, it was Kenneth Christopher, and he was an elder in the church at the time. By the way, he died in November of 2000, not knowing who won the election, whether it was Bush or Gore. Remember the hanging Chad thing and all that? He was watching that on CNN, of all things, and there was no Fox News then, but he never knew who won the election, so I know that's what he's going to ask. all right. So Nancy's at the feast in 1974. We're up in the Poconos. Well, one night near the end of the feast, I didn't want to be in the hotel room with Mom and Dad. So I said, can I have the car? And I drove into Stroudsburg. And I was going to meet my sister and my brother-in-law, who were already married then, and was just going to go in and hang out at the restaurant with them for a little while. Well, lo and behold, the Christopher family's in the restaurant over in the corner. So, hello. And my brother-in-law, Lyle, he looks at me and he says, Ron, says, I'll give you $100 if you go over and ask Nancy to marry you. So I get up out of my chair and I walked over and I said, hello, would you marry me? And she said, who are you? Get out. No. She wasn't quite that reactive, but I quickly explained that I was trying to win a bet from my brother-in-law who has never paid to this day. I knew you'd ask me. So anyway, Nancy and I started talking, and long story short, there's more to the story, but I asked her for a date, and she said yes, and we were going to go to Bushkill Falls up in the Poconos. And, you know, have you ever been to Bushkill Falls? Well, I never have either because we didn't go. I pick her up the next day, and we get in the car, and she starts talking about how exciting it would be. We're so close to New York City. Wouldn't it be great to see New York City? Your wish is my command. It wasn't quite like that, but I said, well, I'd like to see it too. And she said, you know, well, let's go. So we went to New York City, and there was no GPS. I didn't know what it was. We had something called, kids, a map. It's this thing on paper that you read. Okay. You know, old folks, you know what a map is. But we followed the map, and we made it to New York City. And, of course, the closer you get, what do you see there? Not the World Trade Towers. They hadn't been built yet. It was the Empire State Building. So we drove to the Empire State Building, found a place to park the car, which was a miracle in itself, and went up to the top of the Empire State Building. And no, I didn't even hold her hand. She asked me, but I was too shy, remember? So we went to Macy's, and we went to where you could see the Statue of Liberty. And that was our first date. Well, I was struck. I was smitten. So we kept dating and corresponding, and so finally, April the 20th, 1975, that's our anniversary date. So we were married April 20th, 1975. Well, soon after that, we moved to Ohio for better employment. I was still living in West Virginia at the time. So we moved to Ohio for better employment, and I got a job at a place called Capital Finance in Logan, Ohio. So some of you know where Logan is. You've heard of the Hocking Hills, you know, Old Man's Cave. Okay, that's where we lived. That's where we really started up our life together, was in Logan. So I was hired at Capital Finance, And I told the guys that hired me about the Sabbath. That's no problem. And I said, I'm going to be taking off in the fall to go to the Feast of Tabernacles. This was in June. And I said, I'm going to go to the Feast of Tabernacles. They said, okay, that's fine. No problem. You can have the time off. 1 week later, those two men that hired me were fired for mismanagement of the office. Little did I know that. So they bring in two new guys, and I've got seniority now after 1 week. Yeah. No, at least with that particular office. So they said, things are going to change around here. And I said, okay, I'm up for that. So we have to get caught up on everything, so you have to work on Saturday. I said, well, no, I can't work on Saturday. And I told the people that I can't work on Saturday. They don't work here anymore. We do. You're going to work on Saturday. I said, no, I'm not. Then you're going to work on Sunday. Okay, I worked on Sunday. That's fine. Well, you know what the next big obstacle was that was going to come along. They kept the Feast of Tabernacles back in 1975. So, you know, I said, I'm going to go to the feast. They said, no, you're not. You don't have the vacation time. I said, I'm going. So, no, you're not. So I took it to the Equal Rights Commission, Civil Rights or whatever, and appealed my case and said, this is discrimination. And they said, yeah, it is. We'll let you have 4 days. And I said, no, I'm going for all 8 days. Well, if you go for 8 days, don't bother coming back. I didn't bother going back. I was fired. So I come back from the Feast of Tabernacles in October of 19, well, actually, the last day of September, because the feast was really early that year. And I had a new wife and no job whatsoever, no prospects. So I show up at an employment agency. They had an employment agency in Logan at the time. And I knock on the door, I go in and have an interview. What can you do? Well, not much of anything. I've got an associate degree in theology from an unaccredited school down in Texas. And I'd done a little bill collecting in my time. But, oh, well, all right. Well, I heard there was a job for an assistant bill collector over at the hospital right across the street there. You can go see if that's still open. So I did. I went over, and sure enough, the guy talked with me. He interviewed me. And I got up and I left. I said, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. And I went out to the car. Okay, then I went back in. And I said, no, I haven't told him the truth. I haven't been up front with him. And so I said, sir, I said, I need to tell you the real reason that I'm looking for a job. You know, doesn't it seem a little unusual that I'm looking for a job with no experience here? And I said, well, I got fired from Capital Finance for going to the Feast of Tabernacles. And I felt I needed to go, and they wouldn't let me have the time off, and so they fired me. He said, thanks for letting me know. Talk to you later. Later was the next morning. I got a call from him, and he said, we'd like for you to come in and meet the administrator. Can you come in today and see the administrator? I said, well, yes, sir, I can. So I met with the administrator for about 2 hours, and he says, well, when can you start? I said, Thursday? And he said, okay, Thursday. So I was unemployed for 3 days after being fired for the feast with having no prospects whatsoever. And that's a miracle right there. So I worked for this guy that hired me for about 15 years. So after a few years, I knew him really well. And I've been in on interviews with him for people in our department. And so I said, I know you. I said, it made no sense for you to hire me. Remember that time when I applied for the job? I said, why did you hire me? He said, frankly, Ron, I wasn't. Until you came back and told me why you were looking for a job, that you got fired for going to your church thing. He said, anyone who is willing to lose their job in a situation like you had is someone that I wanted working for me. So he hired me right then. And we got along pretty good. So I stayed there for 15 years. But that brings us now, let's see, that was 1975 where I started there. Let's bring that forward to 1977. A major event took place in our lives on April the 4th, 1977. And that miracle is sitting here and gave the opening prayer today. And you all know who Scott is. Scott's got four kids. They range in age from, if I can get it right, 11 to 27. Anyway, people say, well, at least you're close to your family now. So, yeah, here he's come to see us already. And we have a daughter. You know, I think all of you know who Jennifer is, Jennifer Messerly. She's married to Chad Messerly. He's the associate pastor in Newark, or that's Columbus, Cambridge. Also Akron, and he's pastor in Buffalo. He still goes up to Buffalo as well. They live in Canal Fulton. I think you know that. That's between Akron and Canton. And they have two daughters, Abby and Anna. And I mentioned to some of the guys, you know who Abby is. And they have a dog, Bernard. So if you want to meet Bernard, he's going to be at our house next week. So he's one of those inside dogs that, I don't know, they want those fancy kinds. Anyway, Bernard. All right. Now, when Nancy was pregnant with Jennifer, she had a very difficult pregnancy. Most of the pregnancy, she was a high-risk pregnancy. And she was put on bed rest about 4 months before the baby was due. The baby was due to be born in February, and sometime, I think it was November, Nancy was put on total bed rest. Well, about 3 weeks later, she was admitted to the High State University Hospital in an effort to try to keep the baby from being born too soon. I have in my notes, you were admitted to the hospital December the 24th. I think that's when she was actually admitted to the hospital. Jen was born January 3rd, 1981, and she weighed in at a whopping 3 pounds, 7 ounces. But the day before, on January 2nd, they had done a test of some kind. Amniocentesis comes to mind. I think that's what it was. Yeah. And the doctor had told us the baby can't be born yet. Her lungs are not developed. If she's born, she won't survive. And so she was born a few hours later, that early morning of January the 3rd. But miraculously, she was on room air within 12 hours. Her lungs were fully developed, and the doctors either didn't know what they were talking about, or God said, I think I'm going to let this little one live and become our Jennifer. So she did. Well, that wasn't the end of the drama on that day. A few hours after Nancy's emergency C-section, which was in the morning, Nancy started to crash, literally. They bring in the crash cart. She coded. Her heart stopped, and they had to do all that stuff to bring her back, and that happened twice. And she almost died. But her dad was there. I mentioned Kenneth Christopher. He was there. Of course, he committed and anointed her, and we were all praying for her. Some of the family was there. Scott doesn't remember this night very well. But anyway, by the next day, she was practically back to normal. So obviously a direct miracle from God there. All right, let's fast forward a little bit. I mentioned that I was at Hocking Valley Hospital for 15 years. An opportunity came up at a hospital in Cambridge, Ohio, called Southeastern Ohio Regional Medical Center. And by this time, I had been going to Cambridge Church. I'd been in Parkersburg, but I went up to Cambridge for some church assignments since 1986. I like to play the piano, and I can do song leading. It's down, in, out, up. I know song leading a little bit. And so in 1988... I was given an opportunity to do a sermonette. I was asked at a Bible study on a Wednesday night, I want you to do a sermonette. And I said, no. Are you kidding me? I can't do that. And he said, well, think about it. So I thought about it for about 3 months. And I finally put some notes together, and I thought, okay, I'll give it a try. But I want to do it in Cambridge because I don't want to do it in local church because I feel uncomfortable speaking in front of the local crowd, you know. So send me to Cambridge. So I did. So I started giving sermonettes in 1988. The first topic of my sermonette, the title was Don't Be Too Shy to Be a King, because I was so shy, you know. And I said, wait a minute, what's God preparing us for? We got to teach people. We have to be able to stand up in front of people and teach. And, you know, so we're going to be kings and priests. Are you going to be too shy to be a king? So that's what I spoke about. And I haven't shut up since. All right. So again, I like going to Cambridge. Well, here comes an opportunity at the hospital there in 1990. And so I applied for that job, and I was the 11th applicant and the last one, and they hired me. It wasn't a crazy story like the other one, but they hired me. So now we're up in actually living in New Concord, which is about 10 miles from Cambridge. Still go to church, and obviously, And I was ordained as a deacon in 1992. I was over in Wheeling. Bill Winter ordained me as a deacon. You know Mark Winter, and this would be his dad, Carolyn Winter's deceased husband. He ordained me in 1992. So I was enjoying serving in the church. And then that brings us 3 years later to the events of 1995. And I was kidding the folks in Indianapolis this morning. I said, you all had something to do with that, didn't you? You know, the conference was in Indianapolis. Yeah, I don't think they had too much to do with it. But all right, so that was a difficult year for all of us who lived through that at the time. I suspect several of us here did. And we were shocked and saddened by what happened, but we came out of it stronger for it. So I will tell you sometime in a Bible study how I knew exactly what to do, and my choice was easy. It had something to do with standing fast and holding fast to the truth that we've been taught. So back to Nancy a little bit. We'll shift gears. In the mid-1990s, Nancy's health was beginning to deteriorate quite rapidly. She had difficulty with muscle coordination, and she had numbness in her hands and arms. The symptoms, the doctors thought that she had multiple sclerosis. However, in 1996, she was eventually diagnosed with a condition called Arnold-Chiari syndrome, or Arnold-Chiari malformation. Chiari is C-H-I-A-R-I. It's a neurological disorder. Basically, it's a herniated brain at the back of the skull. And she was going to need surgery to correct the problem, or it would have left her in a wheelchair within just a few years. So she had the surgery January of 1997, January 1997. The surgery did not cure the condition. It just kept it from getting worse. So Nancy does have a few symptoms. You'll notice some of them. Sometimes her voice is a little bit hoarse and she's a little bit hard to understand. She has a considerable lack of mobility and range of motion. She can't do this, so I don't have to, you know, it's like reach up for something. She can't do that. And she doesn't really reach out and sock me upside the head either. So she has problems with mobility. She can't do steps, even the smallest steps give her difficulty. So we work with that and appreciate that. So if you have steps at your home and we're going to come to visit, we have to talk about that in advance, how we're going to get Nancy into the house. And where there's a will, there's a way. We'll make it happen. All right. Back to me a little bit. I was ordained as an elder on May the 22nd, 1999, right before Pentecost, the day before Pentecost. My pastor at the time was Gene Knoll. Some of you know Jan Knoll over in Columbus. This is Gene Knoll. He died in 2002. But he came to my house under the pretense of talking with me about the feast, because I was the festival advisor for our local congregation. He said, I want to talk to you about the feast. So, okay, come on over. So he's sitting there. I'm sitting on the piano bench. He's sitting in a rocking chair, just rocking. He starts grinning. He said, Ron, it says, that wasn't the real reason I came over here. So I came over here to tell you I'm going to ordain you as an elder. And I said, no, you're not. And he said, yes, I am. Yeah, well, you can see who won. It was hard to talk him out of it. So I was beginning to be able to serve the church even in greater ways. They let me speak a little more and eventually even give a sermon, which was absolutely miraculous for that to happen. So meanwhile, I was working as director of patient accounts at the hospital since 1990. I was enjoying my job. I was really good at it. We had a staff of about 40 people that I was director of, and we made a really good team. So I'm calling these the growing years, growing in the middle age, 1999 through 2005. So then, 2005, I was unexpectedly given a new role at the hospital. They said, oh, you don't need to take your time worrying about administrative issues and staffing issues and all that kind of stuff. We're going to take all your staff away from you, and we're going to give you a new title. You're going to be the revenue cycle director. And you're going to be all by yourself. And I said, really? Don't do that, because I can't do what I do without my team. That's how we do. That's how we're successful in what we do. So they would not have it. They put another person in charge of the business office part, the I was accounts receivable. So who did they put in charge of my department? The guy from accounts payable. That made no sense. Who did they put in charge of the registration or the admitting office? The lady who works with the volunteers. Because, you know, customer service and all. So people who really didn't know what they were doing were now in charge of my department. But I was another department now. I was revenue cycle director, and I had to make it work. But I was very unhappy, but still tried to make the most of it. And so we did. I assembled a team of about six people, and we were very successful at what we were doing. So I was invited in June of 2006 to give a presentation at the Ohio Hospital Association. I know this is not really a Sabbath, you know, we're going to get to the scriptures. Well, this is just once, and this is special, so bear with me a little bit. So, all right, I'm asked to give a presentation at the Ohio Hospital Association about what we had done that made the extra money for the hospital. So I was the guest speaker and going to speak in front of about 500 people the next day. Well, that night, Richard Pennelly called Nancy. Yeah, and Nancy calls me and said, "You got to call Mr. Pennelly back. He wants to talk to you." What have I done? You know, that kind of thing. So I called him back, and he says, "Ron," he says, "we want you to come to Cincinnati to apply for a job." Cincinnati. So I said, "No, I've got a job. I'm not interested." And he went on to let me know. He said, "We're going to interview six men and hire three." So I thought, okay, there's no way they're going to offer the job to me. I'm too old. I'm too inexperienced. I don't know what I'm doing. They're just being kind to the old man. That's what I thought. So I went there, and I had a good time with the interview. I interviewed with Lyle Welty and Jim Franks. And at the end of the interview, we talked for a couple hours. Mr. Welty escorted me down, and I said to him, "How do you think it went?" He smiled. And he says, "I think it went okay." So little did I know. But anyway, sure enough, a few weeks went by. They hadn't yet told me a decision. They hadn't told me I was hired, but I thought it's going to come. And so I would walk the neighborhood. I'd walk over to the high school where our kids went to school. And one evening I told God I needed a sign. You ever done that? You ever ask God to show you a sign? He'll do it. And you better say, "In your mercy." Yeah, so I asked for a sign, and I was to get it. Directly after that, within a day or two, my hospital world began falling apart. My boss comes over to my office, and he says, "Come on, Ron, we're going to go for a walk." "Okay, let's go for a walk, Don." Yeah, so I didn't know what was happening. So we take it just a few steps out, and he says, "So the administrator of the hospital sent me over here to fire you." "You're kidding. What? No, Ron, I'm not kidding. I'm serious." I said, "What are you talking about?" And he proceeded to tell me that three of my coworkers had made accusations against me that previous week, almost on the same day. And three different charges, all false. Friends of mine, people I had worked with for years, knew them well. So my question, why didn't they come to me? Why didn't they ask me? Why didn't my boss ask me? Why didn't he challenge? But he didn't know, "We're going to fire you." So I said, "Don," I said, after he explained what was going on, I said, "That's not true. That didn't happen that way. Or I know what I did, and what I did was correct." So he said, "You've got 2 weeks to prove it." So I set about proving my innocence in 2 weeks. And sure enough, I was able to give a presentation to the administrator and a couple of the other bigwigs of the hospital, and they believed me. And they said, "I see you're innocent after all." So my boss told, or the administrator told my boss, "Well, Kelly can stay, but you tell him he's not welcome here anymore." "He's not welcome here? Why? I proved my innocence. You know, why would you tell me that?" And so it hit me. I had asked for a sign. "You're not welcome here anymore." And I knew where that sign was coming from and who was saying that. So that kind of convinced me that I knew I didn't belong there anymore. And sure enough, I got the letter inviting me to become a pastor, and I accepted. And so that's how it happened. I put in my resignation and worked another month. On the last day of my employment, one of the men who had made one of the accusations against me, I didn't ever talk to the two others, but one, I was really close to him, and I said, come back to my office. So we went back, and I said, sit down. And he sat down in the chair, and I said, Tom, I said, I need to know something. I said, why did you do that? Why did you make that accusation against me? And he put his hands in his face, and he started to cry. And he said, Ron, says, I don't know why I did that. I don't know what came over me. Can you ever forgive me? And I said, yes, because I knew what had come over him. See, you know, God had been working with him to make that accusation as well as the other two. So that was clear. It's what I needed. I needed that confidence, and I knew that God was working with me. And there was no worry then about accepting the offer because I knew this wasn't just a mistake by Mr. Welty or Mr. Franks or any of the others. God was calling me to this, to the ministry. And still I kept telling myself, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do this job. It's too overwhelming. It's too much responsibility. I don't know enough to be a pastor. I don't know how to work with people. I can't solve their problems. I can't. And it finally hit me what I was saying. I can't. You know where I'm going, but God can. And when that hit me, when I realized that, it was like the whole weight of the world fell off my shoulders. And that's what I've depended on ever since. It's not me. It's God does the work through me, and I believe that. So I was approved for the being hired into the program, into the ministerial trainee program. That was October 24th, 2006. I was mentored directly by a gentleman I think many of you know, Randy Stiver. Randy is not with our organization. He's now retired from the other organization, but we worked well together. I learned a lot about how to make coffee. And so, if you know Randy Stiver, you know his love for coffee. Then there were the three 2-week-long pastoral training classes. So it was the second one. It was in March of 2007 that the three of us, by the way, I was hired at the same time as Paul Carter and John Pinelli. The three of us were hired on the same day. I had a meeting with Mr. Franks and was told where I was going to be sent. Of course, you always wonder, where are they sending me? And I thought I had it figured out. I actually thought it was going to be Akron, but it wasn't. Mr. Myers was still there. So I was to follow Mr. Myers a bit later on. So he says, North Carolina. I said, North Carolina? That never even entered my mind. He said, well, yeah, we want you to go replace Jim Hafley. Jim Hafley was going to be sent down to Florida and be the regional pastor and so on. So, welcome to North Carolina. I was assigned to Asheville and to Hickory and to Greensboro. And that's where we were for quite a while. And then came 2010. Anybody know anything that happened in the year 2010? I had some personal experience with what happened that year, given my position in the ministry. So I knew a little bit about how to help people and how to guide them through their decision-making process without attempting to make that decision for them. So you may know, I was one of the men. It was on December 1st, 2010, Mr. Kubik asked me to come up to Cincinnati, and they wanted to interview me and talk with me. So the last time I was in Cincinnati for anything business to do with the church, I was fired. So I hope that doesn't happen this time. So at any rate, so I was to have the Asheville congregation until March of 2012. And March of 2012, they took that away from me and gave me Raleigh on the opposite side of the state. So I was replacing Clyde Kylo, who was being asked to come to Texas and be in charge of the media department. So that's what we had since 2012. We had Hickory and Greensboro and Raleigh congregations. All right, a little bit more on Nancy's health. As some of you know, Nancy has endured several other health issues over the years. In 2015, she was diagnosed with endometrial cancer, and that's always a scare when they say that word to you. So she had surgery for that. And there's been no sign of it since. She's had the regular checkups ever since, and there's been no return. The next year, 2016, she was diagnosed with spinal stenosis. She was having continued more severe neurological issues, And so they decided they had to do spinal surgery to correct the condition, or she would be virtually unable to walk. So that surgery did leave her basically paralyzed for several days. Right after the surgery, she wasn't able to move. You know, she could wave, and that was about it. She couldn't do anything for herself. So they were giving her lots of physical therapy and rehab and so forth. So over the next few weeks, she regained her ability to walk. But again, to this day, she has quite limited mobility issues. She can't do steps well. She can't get up off a chair. You'll see me helping her stand up, like when we do the hymns. She has to have a little assistance getting up. The numbness is still there in her arms and her hands, so she'll often get burned. So you'll see sometimes she'll have a Band-Aid on because she doesn't feel the heat of the pain of the heat, you know, so she gets burned. But here she is, and she has had a history of making it. She doesn't stay home and say, I'm too tired. You know, she comes to services. She's been doing the circuit with me for all these years, plans to keep doing it as long as she can. So we enjoy being here. So, all right, just backtracking just a little bit. When I was hired in 2006, I told Mr. Franks, I'm too old. I was 52 at the date I was hired, the time I was hired. And he said, oh, Ron says, we're going to get a good 20 years out of you. So I expected to be in North Carolina for 10 of those years. You know, I thought, well, half and half. They'll keep me here, and then they'll transfer me for 10 more years, and then that'll be it. Well, that didn't happen. Nothing happened after 10 years, and nothing happened after 15 years. It was to be one more year, 16 years. And that was unexpected. So if I was only going to have 20 years, that means I get to be with you 3.5 more years. And at least that's what I thought. But apparently that's not what they do anymore. You have to work till you're 100 or so. But anyway, certainly many pastors are working up into their late 70s or something, but not sure I'll make it or not, but while I'm here, I'll do the best I can to serve you. So, again, here we are. God has worked many miracles in my life, and he's directly involved in every step. So a little few personal comments now. I am not Dave Myers. Obviously, I can't tell jokes quite as good as he can, but I'm working on it. I thought that would get a lot more response there. And I'm not Lyle Welty. And he was an amazing pastor here and still is. Of course, I was able to see him last week, and he did, Nancy's sister died, and he did the funeral service for her, so I saw him there. But we're going to do our very best to serve you, to encourage you, to teach you, but most importantly, just to love you. So a little story. When I left Columbus back in 2006, 2007 it was then. I'd had the training. It was 2007. It was our last Sabbath in Columbus. So Mrs. Knoll, Jan Knoll, she's going to tell me goodbye. You know, and she gives me a hug, and she looks me in the eye, and she's crying. And she says, if Gene were here, that's her husband, if Gene were here, this is what he would tell you. He would say, love the brethren. And she stopped with that. That's all she was. So I said, okay, and that's what I tried to do for these past 16 years, and that's what we'll continue to do here. Now, let's do the Bible just a little bit more. Let's go to Ephesians 4. I want to cover my goals for the congregation. Ephesians 4, and we'll start in verse 11. He himself gave some to be. Now we have the different responsibilities, apostles, prophets, evangelists. We're more familiar here, pastors and teachers. For the equipping of the saints, that's you, for the work of ministry, for the edifying, or the building up of the body of Christ. How long? Until we all come to the unity of the faith, we come to the knowledge of the Son of God, until we come to being a perfect man, individual, of course, up to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. That's our goal. So that we should no longer be children. We grow past that. Who are children, who are unsteady and easy to be shaken, to toss to and fro, carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men, in cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting. You identify with those words. You've lived through it. But speaking the truth in love, that's the important part, in love, and outgoing concern and consideration for one another, in humility, may grow up in all things into Him who is the head of the church, Jesus Christ, from whom the whole body, being joined and knit together by what every joint supplies. You're a joint, okay? According to the effective working by which every part does its share, then it causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. Now, we'll talk more about this in an upcoming sermon. In fact, it's going to be my next sermon. And you're going to hear that passage of Scripture many times over the next few years. It's going to be the foundational principle of my ministry here. And that's what I told North Carolina 16 years ago. And I think I lived up to that promise, and that's what we did. I think we were pretty successful at it. So I want more than anything for us to be a church that's growing together in peace and in harmony, that there's genuine love for one another as we work together towards the reward of God's kingdom. We pray that's coming soon. Now, a few more things that you can expect from me before I close. I covered some of these things at the speakers meeting that I had with them last Sunday. We met together at a restaurant in Batesville, you know, where they make the caskets. I didn't realize that I was so close to Batesville. And I saw this big factory and the big truck. Oh, Batesville caskets. You know, so anyway, but we had just a luncheon get together, and we talked about a few things, the folks from Indianapolis and here as well. So some of the things that I told them, I love socials. I consider myself, I call it a socialaholic. So you have a church social, I want to be there. I want us to have them. So I was quite happy to see the information about your upcoming bonfire. So the first social I hope to be able to attend. And I told them, as I'm telling you, I am not a micromanager. I'm not going to be telling you every detail of every job that needs to be done. And I'm not going to oversee. Now, who's going to take care of this week? Who takes care of it next week? Who does the chairs? Who does the sound system and everything? You all know what to do. So just keep doing it. You know, I'm a macro manager. I oversee it, but you'll do most of the work in doing all the things that make church happen. You know how to make church happen, so I know that you'll do that. I am going to stress leadership development over the next few years that I'm here. We will begin to have regular what I call men's clubs. We'll have it after services, probably on the times when I'm only here. Would work best that we'll just get all the men together and we'll cover a topic for about 30, 35 minutes, and you'll get up on your feet and you'll talk, and the teens, you're invited as well. And it's not spokesman's club or anything like it, but it's just a chance to cover a topic and meet together and discuss the topic as the men of the congregation. We'll have ladies' clubs as well, topics that are appropriate for the ladies. Nancy and Mrs. Tootle will be working on that as well. I will be working more directly with some of you in extra mentoring and extra leadership development, especially if you're speaking now through personal meetings, or we will have some video conference calls. I used to have personal meetings, but COVID, of course, stopped that, and we were able to start doing a free conference call or Zoom or something like that for our meetings, and that worked out well. That was successful, so I'll probably start that up early next year. Now, one more thing, and I'm not being critical or anything, but I'm just going to tell it like it is. Sometimes I notice on the schedule, and other churches have done this as well, when they don't have a sermonette speaker, they'll play in a chord. And I think you've had that here a few times. I don't personally care for that. I like to watch in a chord Friday night when I'm having supper. So that's what we've done. And so we have not done that for the past year since Intercord's had in North Carolina. But that's really because we've had an abundance of speakers. We're going to have an abundance of speakers. That's what I'm getting at. See, it's about the leadership training and the sermonette development. So hopefully we'll have that. Should there be a time when we absolutely don't have a speaker, And rather than play in a chord, I have access to video sermonettes, kind of like we had the video special music. We can have a video sermonette. I know a lot of the guys in North Carolina who've given some really great sermonettes, and I thought, why not play one of them? I thought you'd rather see that than hear in a chord, especially like next week, an in a chord was scheduled for Indianapolis. There is no in a chord next week. So they're going to get the sermonette that was given today in Raleigh. They'll have a video of that next week. I listened to that live on the way over here. So that's the kind of technology, the things that we can do and make available. So that's kind of my plan. If you don't like that, tell Mr. Myers. I don't know. Okay. No, I kid just a little bit. Call me anytime for anything except the middle of the night. And here's why. Laying my cards on the table, I've got pretty severe insomnia issues that I've been dealing with for quite a while. So I have trouble sleeping, and I have to take medication to help me sleep, or I don't sleep. So I'm working on that, but if you call me in the middle of the night and say, I need you to come anoint me, I'm at the hospital, I'll say, see you in the morning, because I'm not allowed to drive. It would not be safe for me to drive. So hopefully we're working on that, but until God heals that, I still have to have some help sleeping at night. I've got in my notes, thankfully nobody's had to call me in the middle of the night in North Carolina for many years. I think it's been like 15 years ago that it was the last call I had in the middle of the night. It just didn't seem to happen. So maybe you guys are different. You do that. Sorry. But all right. Even though I have been a church pastor now, I've had some experience under my belt, 16 years, bear with me and understand I may not know all the answers. I do not know all the answers. But as I say, I'll get with you. I'll get back with you. We'll work on it together. We'll find the answers. We are also very receptive to receiving invitations from you to visit you in your home. We like to do that over the next few months. Make sure that we have visited with everyone. If you don't want me to come to your home, or if your home is just totally inaccessible to us, to Nancy, I can make a list of the restaurants I like. Olive Garden is not one of them. I have to tell you a story. Okay, so our very first, when we moved to North Carolina, so one of the guys in North Carolina invites Nancy and us, Nancy and me, to dinner at Olive Garden. And already then, 15 years ago, 16 years ago, I didn't really care for Olive Garden. But I didn't say anything. You know, I just enjoyed it and tolerated it, and we had a good visit. It was some years later, he finds out I don't like Olive Garden. And he says, why didn't you tell me? I said, are you kidding? I could not tell you that, you know, I didn't like Olive Garden. How rude would that have been? So turns out this was the last couple that we had a dinner with before we left North Carolina. We went out to dinner. Where did we go? No, we went to the Old West restaurant that had a steak, so it was not, but it brought back. So they were the first, they were the last, so interesting. But I could handle Olive Garden, but just, you know, only if I have to. And this is going out on the web. Suddenly Olive Garden's, it's probably on my phone's listening, and I'm going to get commercials for Olive Garden, I know. All right, anyway, we would like for you to invite us rather than we don't, like, push ourselves on you and say, hey, I'm going to be at your house next Wednesday at 3, you know, and by the way, have supper ready. And we don't do it that way. So you can invite us at your schedule when you want us to be there, and we'd love to have you, or love to visit with you. So, all right, I'm going to quit. As we start another chapter in the story of the congregation of Cincinnati-Dayton, working together, we will accomplish the work that is needed to continue to grow in spiritual maturity, to become a spiritually strong congregation. I have an entire sermon I'll give on that someday, how to be a spiritually strong congregation as we're preparing for God's kingdom. We're going to close back to the Bible with 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 5. Paul writes about his time in the church and his leadership. He says, he's like, who am I? Who is Paul? Who's Apollos? They're just ministers through whom you believed. They were being taught the truth. They believed him as the Lord gave to each one. So Paul says, I planted, Apollos watered, but it was God that gave the increase. So then neither he who plants is anything, nor he who waters. God gives the increase. Now he who plants and he who waters are one. Each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. For we are God's fellow workers. We are all in this together. You're the field. You're God's building. You are God's temple. You're being built into a great temple. according to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I helped lay the foundation, but yet another built upon that. But let each one take heed how he is building on that foundation. For no other foundation can anyone lay that which is laid than that which is laid. And of course, that's Jesus Christ. And that's certainly going to be our foundation going forward. So like I say, there's others who have been here before me, prior to Mr. Welty even, in the years past. You've had different ministers through the years. And you'll likely have someone after me, however long I have to be here or however long it is till Christ returns. But we will build on one another, and our goal is like Ephesians 4. That's the whole goal of the congregation, for this church to grow to love one another and build and edify itself in love. So I look forward to getting to know all of you as soon as possible, because now you all know who we are. Have a rest of your happy Sabbath. I'm looking forward to your Thanksgiving dinner tonight.